Welcome to the East County Magazine live radio show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio representing the public interest, not special interest. Broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso on KNSJ 89.1 FM, your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the San Diego Performance Academy. We open our show today with news about a new mayor in El Cajon and a vacancy on the council to be filled. We'll also have a special report on a proposal to make San Diego and East County into a national drone test site. We have an important health alert about an E. coli outbreak and a warning for homeowners about a home equity scam that could cost you your home. Stay tuned for details on a new campaign called Unplug the NSA. Helen Ofield is back with Sounds of History, bringing us a memoir from a woman who worked in a lemon grove lemon packing plant during the Great Depression. Plus, we'll have the latest edition of the East County Magazine Trivia Quiz and a lot more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. This is Miriam Raftery with some breaking news on El Cajon filling its mayoral vacancy. El Cajon's City Council voted unanimously on Tuesday night to appoint Councilman Bill Wells to fill the vacancy left by Mayor Mark Lewis's resignation. Council also voted to have an application and qualifications drawn up for people who want to be appointed to fill the vacancy on the City Council left by Wells' appointment to become mayor. A crowd filled the council chambers with many community members voicing views on how the city should fill its leadership positions. Bonnie Price asked council to approve a special election to fill the mayoral vacancy. She said an appointment would discourage people from having faith in their city government.
As you know, the city of El Cajon is the poorest city in the county. It has 30% of its population living at or below the poverty line. This population needs to be organized and have someone to champion its concerns at the ballot box.
She asked that if the council did opt for an appointment to fill the vacancy, that Ben Colasho, a Chaldean Iraqi who narrowly missed winning election in the last race, should be chosen. But a special election would be costly, $15,000 to $40,000 if added to the June ballot, and even higher if a special election was held on a different date. Developer Neil Arthur urged council to make an appointment, stating, "I'm not worried about the public not being included because you gentlemen were elected by the public." The council currently consists of 4 white Republican men. However, El Cajon is almost half minorities now and nearly half Democratic. Frank Simbukakis, president of the East County Democratic Club, said the opening is a chance to bring diversity to the council. Richard Gray, a resident, also called for change, noting that the council currently does not include a woman or any minorities. He added,
"You need to have diversity, and that is something important. People are talking about Chaldeans. We have other people here. And the fact is that each one of you is a conservative Christian. We have people here that are not Christians and that are not conservative."
Jonathan Goetz asked if council members had discussed appointing Wells outside of a public hearing and suggested that if so, that could constitute a Brown Act violation. Wells heatedly denied that suggestion, adding, "Even though you have a microphone, it does not protect you from the rules of libel and slander." Vicki Butcher, who served 3 terms on the city's planning commission, asked to be considered for appointment to fill the council seat. Butcher talked with East County Magazine after the hearing to share her qualifications and her reactions.
"It is a privilege to say that I have served on this El Cajon Planning Commission for 3 full terms, that is 12 years, and having chaired it on 2 occasions. The issue of what criteria will be used, it will be an interesting thing to see, because that was the criteria for the last appointment."
Butcher recalled that the vacancy created by the resignation of Councilwoman Jillian Hanson-Cox was filled by Tony Ambrose, who had served on the Planning Commission, at the time a requirement that council said was critical. A qualification that Butcher also shares.
And it cut out quite a few of the people that were in the mix to seek the appointment. Now that they have a person who has gained an appointment and has been duly elected as an incumbent, perhaps we will see if the requirements shift, change, or are different.
Another name being mentioned as a potential successor to Wells on the council is Star Bales, a Chaldean woman currently serving on the city's planning commission. Backers of Kalasho also ask that he be considered for that slot. Some speakers ask council to hold a special election for the council seat, which has nearly 3 years remaining in the term. But council members voiced support to fill the vacancy by appointment, since the council has important matters to consider, and currently there is a potential for a 2-2 deadlock on votes. An application for the council vacancy will be posted on the city's website and available at City Hall by Monday, November 18th, with a December 4th deadline to apply. Council hopes to fill the vacancy at its December meeting, however. If the members are unable to agree on who should be chosen by January 12th, then a special election must be held. Several members of the public also came to voice dismay at Mayor Lewis's resignation, following remarks deemed racially insensitive. Sam Abad said he's known the mayor for 12 years. I don't believe there is a racist bone in this man's body, he added, and noted that Lewis had helped him with his businesses through the years. Farouk Georges called remarks made against Lewis vicious and said attacks on the mayor were shameful and improper. Another speaker suggested that the push to force Lewis from office was motivated by merchants angered over the city's new restrictive alcohol ordinance, but said such views do not reflect the Chaldean community overall. But Mark Arabo, head of the Neighborhood Markets Association, insisted that Lewis's remarks were disgraceful and asked council to hold district elections.
In all the disgraceful things that Mark Lewis has said on the one-hour audio tape, that he recognized that his time for serving the city has gone, and I think that no one should rejoice that he's gone. I think we should all take this opportunity to heal the city, because I think we have an opportunity to embrace everything that everyone's talking about today, the last council hearing. And furthermore, I think there's a way we could bring on more representation, district-wide elections, to bring on, if you live on Avocado, you have your own council member. If you live on Magnolia, you have your own council member. So accountability, I think right now, it's a perfect opportunity for you guys to show leadership. And I can tell you, we want to be with you part of the solution. We want to help each other.
But Arabo's remarks sparked contention even within El Cajon's immigrant community. A boisterous crowd prompted Wells to call for order at one point.
As far as the Chaldean community goes, there's one leader. That's our bishop. Bishop Serranius of Jomo, all the Chaldeans, and I can tell you guys...
We don't accept him.
Now, I can tell you guys that, with all due respect for the church, I can tell from the foothills and the pastors and the Chaldean church, I don't know what church the Chaldeans are part of, but as far as the leader for community goes, it's Bishop Serranius. Now, I'm telling you...
He's not.
For the city of El Cajon, to heal.
Mark, can I interrupt for a second? I want to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to speak, but let's keep the council meetings civil. Mr. Arabo needs to have his chance to speak. You'll get your chance to speak, too.
Arabo continued.
And I want to say that we should debate the issues, but not divide. I hope this is good therapy for the city of El Cajon, because we need it. A safe El Cajon for our families. El Cajon that's booming with business. And I think this is a real opportunity, and I hope to work with you, Bill Wallace, Gary Kendrick, Tony Ambrose, Bob McClellan. Hope to work with you to bring better representation, district election as opposed to citywide. That way, citizens that live in a certain corner of the city could have people they could hold accountable, just like the city of San Diego, like the city of Chula Vista, like the city of Escondido. That way we could have an African-American on the council like Myrtle Cole in the city of San Diego. We could have a gay mayor like Todd Gloria. We need this kind of things for the city, any city. We need to embrace the diversity. And I think we're on the same page. This is a very positive meeting. And I hope this is not the end. I hope it's the beginning. And I can tell you, the whole world is watching. And rhetoric comes, rhetoric goes. People bring written statements for them. I'm speaking from my heart. And I'm telling you, the whole world is watching. And this is a crossroads for El Cajon.
Tony Sutil rose to speak, challenging Arabo's views.
I am an Italian, and I am also an immigrant. When we came to this country, we came to the purpose to assimilate. We left Italy for the bad that was in Italy. And we embraced America, not throwing away the good that was in Italy, but we embraced what is good in America. However, all people are of one race, the human race. The California voting rights law is a travesty on human race in that it promotes prejudice and discrimination for the few to grasp money and power. Law professor Joaquin Avila and Robert Rubin were the drafters of the California Voting Rights Act, and their firm and attorneys have profited from the law in the tune of $4.3 million. I believe Mr. Arbo is not a friend of the Chaldean community, but a usurper of moral peace and a promoter of community disintegration. Divide and conquer, in my opinion, is the principle behind Mr. Arbo.
Wells called the past few weeks difficult for the city, but added, now that the storm has passed, we need to take time to heal. Backcountry Voices held a forum on November 11th in Julian regarding a proposal for testing drone unmanned aerial vehicles over our backcountry in East County and San Diego. The first speaker was John Wraith Snyder, a local resident.
San Diego Military Advisory Council, the Economic Development, and then the third one, Chamber. These were the entities that were backing that. So we could ask, what does that mean? You know, money and military. What does that mix create? So we want to know.
Raithsberger voiced concern that county supervisors and all five congressional representatives have voiced support for this plan and sent letters in support of this plan, all without input from rural residents. The residents are concerned about safety and privacy. They want to know where the drones will take off and land and what exactly they will be testing. Is it surveillance? Is it weaponized technology? Residents also voice concern about what this would mean for the rural lifestyle, for those who came here in the first place to escape the hustle and bustle of city life.
We come because it's pristine, because it's open, because we feel alone. We like to feel the solitude, and so the whole notion that there may be eyes upon us, eyes in the sky. Is that realistic? Is that true? Could that be happening? Yeah.
Dave Patterson with Veterans for Peace spoke on why his group has become involved in the battle over drones.
Veterans for Peace picked up on this drone thing about a year and a half ago when we started seeing these very alarming reports coming out, little information being released about people being killed, innocent civilians, children, you know, majority of people being killed by drones overseas being civilians, and then this thing about the border, the drones on the border, and it just started getting really crazy.
He brought a scale model of a Predator drone and a screen so people could see themselves in the crosshairs, a rather unnerving experience.
First thing we started doing was demonstrating in front of General Atomics out in Poway, where they make these things. This is a Reaper drone, by the way, a weaponized version of the Predator. And that sign that you saw when you came in, 10,000 drones surveilling America, is that okay?
Those in favor of drones argue that the technology will create local manufacturing jobs and jobs for those who operate the unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs. Besides military applications, drones can be used domestically for many purposes. Some have support even from the harshest critics of drones. For instance, using drones in search and rescue operations after an earthquake or natural disaster, or drones to spot wildfires. But others have more troubling implications. Potentially, drones could be used locally to take surveillance video of our region with the ability to zoom in and show detailed activities of residents. Infrared technology could even detect motion inside homes. Unmanned drones could be used to catch speeders on local roadways, flying silently at heights where they would be unseen and unheard. Many people raise concerns over law enforcement using drones to obtain information without warrants, silently spying on law-abiding citizens as well as suspects, activities that some say could violate the Fourth and Fifth Amendments.
We're not against technology. It's going to keep evolving. But the way that technology is being used is alarming.
Next, Patterson showed a video on drones produced by the news network Al Jazeera that raised questions over the international use of drones.
America's increasing reliance on drones in its fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban is causing concern about conflict as just another computer game. But as other countries embrace the technology and drones are adopted for police and civilian use, what are the consequences to civil liberties and the future of war?
A squadron leader at Alamogordo Air Force Base in New Mexico offered this explanation for why the U.S. military favors the use of drones.
Why have drones, or RPAs as you call them, become so popular with the U.S. Air Force? Do you have an explanation for that?
Yeah, they work. They are a force multiplier, and they save lives.
But the film notes there have been many cases of mistaken identities and collateral damage, with innocent civilians, including children, being killed. In countries that we are not at war with, arguably a violation of international law in some cases.
ACLU, the civil rights organization in New York, is currently suing the state for summary executions carried out with drones.
I think there is certainly a concern that the United States is setting a precedent in its use of drones that it would not be happy with other countries using it in the same way. I suspect that the United States will not be so happy if a country like Russia or China or Iran claims the same authority and starts going after United States citizens or others. It's really a dangerous precedent.
The video also revealed that there are small drones the size of insects that can be released in swarms to crawl or fly inside of buildings, surveilling all that they see. And these miniature nano drones are not even included among the drones that could be authorized to fly in U.S. skies in the near future.
National drone testing area that they're proposing, which goes all the way up to the Sierras and encompasses San Diego as well. Separate from that is the fact that Congress has mandated the FAA to open the sky to drones by 2015. And the FAA is saying that could mean as many as 30,000 drones in the sky when they do this. So we at Veterans for Peace think that what's going to happen at that time is our protections of the Fourth Amendment, you know, invasion of privacy and the Fifth Amendment of collecting information on us and the Fifth Amendment, our privacy, they go up in a big cloud of drones.
Patterson raised concerns over some police departments being provided not only surveillance drones, but weaponized drones purchased with our tax dollars.
They have given weaponized technology to these places, and believe me, they will use it against us. Unless we get some rules, we need some strong rules on oversight of where the stuff can be used and how it's used.
The next speaker in Julian was Matthew Kellegrew, a lawyer with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, which is suing the government over the domestic use of drones here in the United States.
What we do with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee is we try to take local issues that implicate the Fourth Amendment or implicate privacy rights and the Bill of Rights generally. And then we try to use transpartisan community organizing. This is a very strange moment in history, and it's sort of a very strange moment politically, where people ordinarily associated with the political right, libertarians, some members of the Republican Party, traditional Republican Party, have a lot of alignment with people traditionally associated with the political left, so it's progressives. And this is happening at the same time as both of those constituent bases are increasingly alienated from their political representatives.
He emphasized that people protesting and speaking out for their rights are making a difference.
The more demonstrations there are, the fewer drone killings there are abroad. In terms of like visibility, this is a real thing. And specifically when it comes to drone regulation, which is something we actually have a lot of control over, more so than, let's say, like the NSA, right? There's not like a town ordinance you can pass that's going to stop the NSA from like reading your emails. But there are town ordinances you can pass that can stop police departments from getting drones, or at least regulate the drone use. So this is one area of the privacy concern, privacy rights world, and sort of the emergent technology meets privacy rights world, where local action has a tremendous impact on a national level.
He also views drones as part of a broader issue involving the erosion of our constitutional rights.
The drones are a piece of the surveillance state. They are not a siloed issue. Like, drones don't fly in a vacuum. Drones collect information, and then they disseminate that information to state organizations who then use that information in enforcement schemes. That's what they do. It's their only job.
He also said that around the world, drones are being used to target people of color, including immigration enforcement actions in the United States.
The drones don't catch that many people on the border, yet they want so many more, and they're so expensive. They're looking 5-8 years ahead, as well should we. To have a biometric tracking feature and a drone at the same time, here you have two different technologies developed through enforcement programs, deployed against politically vulnerable communities of color, incorporated into a state program, and then deployed against everybody else. These are staging grounds.
Calabrese said that several states have tried to regulate drones, but thus far have failed to pass constitutional muster. But privacy rights remain, and he gave a chilling example of just how intrusive drone technology can be.
There's a great article, it came out yesterday, that was authored by a drone pilot. It was kind of like a narrative piece or something like that, like five things that you bet you didn't know about drones or something like that. And he talks about when he was doing drone surveillance in Afghanistan, that they would sit and they would watch people have sex in their houses. And the way that they could do it is by seeing the heat signatures change. And you can use a listening device. They can go fly over your backyard, look at it, they can look over your fence. You can do all sorts of stuff without a warrant. You know, the sanctity of the home is really the defining feature of the Fourth Amendment. That's why we have warrants in the first place.
Next, the attorney spoke about the impact that lobbying by drone manufacturers is having on efforts to regulate drones.
The drone regulation bill in Texas started with a complete ban on law enforcement use. I mean, it was just like a blanket ban, no drones for nobody, period. It was very Texan. It was like they were not messing around. And, you know, through the Senate and debate process, eventually what happened was that, you know, they started putting in these carve-outs. There's basically a tone that the drone conversation goes, and I'll tell you who starts it. It is Boeing and Raytheon, who have very powerful lobbyists who really want drones. So the first thing to do, if you want to destabilize a drone regulation in terms of how law enforcement can use it, potentially in contravening to the Fourth Amendment, the first thing you do is you make it a privacy issue. And then you ban personal uses of drones. Because real, you know, the threat is like, well, what, can my neighbor just get a drone and come point it into my house? And the answer is yes. And so people concerned with drone regulation tend to get distracted by a privacy conversation. And I don't mean distracted in a way that's tends to minimize that. That is a real concern real people could actually have, and there are domestic violence implications and all sorts of reasons why we would want to have private regulations of drones. But to derail the entire conversation around constitutionality with privacy is basically exactly what happened in Texas. So what began with a very constitutionally minded, this has serious Fourth Amendment implications and we really need to be concerned about it bill, got stripped away and basically gave the police free rein to do whatever they want with a drone. And, you know, regulated that an individual's ability to have a drone. And that's how that regulation went forward. And that's actually pretty much a model for how drone regulation is unfolded in pretty much every state.
Regulating drones is a complex matter because of the different levels of government involved. He gave an example, though, of how local governments can make a difference.
The city of Berkeley prevented the police from getting a drone. It really has no bearing on Alameda County. The county can still fly a drone over the city of Berkeley. The city of Berkeley can't obtain a drone on its own. This is why it gets tricky. And this is where local action becomes more agile than national action.
San Diego is one of six regions nationally vying to become a national drone test site, and a decision will be made by the end of the year. The Bill of Rights Defense Committee lawyer offered this advice on effective strategies for those who are opposed to drone testing over San Diego County.
If there's going to be a lot of roadblocks, right? Like if it's going to be a total nightmare to fly a drone in San Diego County, that's going to impact how much funding goes into San Diego. It's going to shift the balance in terms of how attractive a location this is for drone deployment. And frankly, I feel like a success in a place here and the successes that we've had in other places, you know, there's a reason why they're not doing it in Seattle. There's plenty of wilderness in Seattle, too. It's not hard to find a back area there, and they're not pushing these types of things. And this could be a matter of time, but it could also be because of the success in terms of local action against it.
The Bill of Rights Defense Committee will soon be introducing the Unplug the NSA campaign, urging states to simply cut off power and water to entities that are violating constitutional rights through spying on Americans, such as eavesdropping on phone conversations without a warrant. And he suggested that similar methods could be applied to regulate drones.
If law enforcement has decided to be constitutionally unaccountable, perhaps there's something that can be done about it from a manufacturing level, from an air regulation level, from an air quality level. Like there could be all sorts of different mechanical regulations that could disrupt the drone's ability to violate the Fourth Amendment that don't really deal with getting into a constitutional question.
Bill Everett, a Julian resident, explained that drones are presently regulated the same way as model aircraft. He voiced concerns over safety with the potential for thousands of drones, some as cheap as just a couple $100, potentially buzzing around the skies of San Diego County.
In aviation, there's a really simple fundamental principle. It's called see and be seen. It is the responsibility of every pilot on every level to keep his eyes open to see where other aircraft are and avoid them, see and avoid. It's also the responsibility of a pilot, if they have an issue of mechanical failure or something, to do everything they possibly can. They have to land off a field somewhere to do it in a manner and in a location where it won't endanger people on the ground.
He also warned that an FAA ruling could trump local efforts to restrict drones.
There's no municipality that can pass an ordinance saying you can't fly these over our community. FAA takes precedence every single time. I'm very concerned on two levels. First of all, the integration of drones into civilian airspace, because it's already crowded enough out there as it is. I think what they're going to start out testing is the navigation and control systems on the drones, just to make sure that they don't get away from, you know, their controller, wherever it is. They will almost certainly start way out here in the desert with this. And invariably, the way they do this kind of thing is that they put a drone up and they put a chase plane on it. It's literally following the thing, you know, 100 yards away and just keeping an eye on it. If they start using larger drones, I'm quite certain during the test phase, those drones will contain a self-destruct capability. So that if something gets out of control, that they can destroy the aircraft and not have it do a tremendous amount of damage when it hits the ground. Another one of my concerns, and this is actually a much greater concern, and let me say at the outset, I'm not opposed to UAVs or UASs. I'm opposed to some of the things that they're capable of doing. I have a friend who's en route now from the Antarctic, and he took two of these little ones, you know, the ones with the little four blades on, put a GoPro camera on it, went to the Antarctic and flew them over penguin colonies, and now they can come back and recover all that data and do a lot of research that could never be done any other way, especially economical way. But he paid about $700 a piece for these things. And I was looking in the catalog yesterday, and you can actually buy for $79 a little helicopter, remote-controlled helicopter, that has a camera on it, a video camera. My real concern is these things are becoming so common and so inexpensive that everybody and their brother is going to have them. And it seems highly unlikely to me that if you get, you know, 6,000 people in the city of San Diego that own these things, that they're going to have any idea whatsoever that there's only certain places and times that they can fly these things based on the FAA regulations. So if all of a sudden you have 6,000 of these things in your city, people are going to be violating airspace laws left and right, and there's going to be no way to enforce it. And my biggest concern on the privacy side of things is that it's now capable. They have the capability of it. Let's say the El Cajon is a little city down here. Could get a drone. Doesn't even need to be piloted, because even the little tiny ones have GPSs built in them, and you can program them to fly wherever you want. So I can envision a scenario where a drone would be flying with super sophisticated camera on it and just literally flying 24 hours a day and archiving data for wherever we go, whatever. This, in my mind, is the ultimate realization of Big Brother.
Two other concerns raised were the risk of a drone crash starting a fire and the potential for terrorists to send a drone armed with a weapon to attack on domestic soil. Now, the organization Backcountry Voices has a petition on its Facebook page for people who want to sign and voice opposition to drones. They will also be holding another event on December 4th at the Julian Library, and you can find information about that on the Backcountry Voices Facebook page.
I'm John Mattis, investigative guide, host of Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers, shining a light on shady deals all around us.
John Mattis has won 7 Emmy Awards, a Golden Mike, and the Edward R. Murrow Award for Exposing Fraud and Corruption. Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers is produced by the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso.
John Mattis here with Investigative Guy, talking about a crisis that's on the horizon. It's the home equity loan crisis that's about to hit consumers and homeowners all over America. What's happened is, back in 2004, when people looked at their homes and saw an ATM machine, they all got offers for home equity loans. They took out the loans, not thinking about anything, and lo and behold, many, many of those loans have 10-year resets. So what happened is homeowners for the last 10 years have only been paying interest on those loans. Well, get ready to get hit, homeowners. If you took out a loan, a home equity loan in 2004, you're going to get a reset and it's going to be big. You're going to be paying principal and you're going to be paying interest. You could be hit with a $500, $600 increase in your payments per month. And guess what the banks are doing? Nothing. They are not going to protect you. And if you miss so much as one payment, you're going to be ruined with your credit and they're going to come after you for foreclosure. There are $30 billion in resets coming next year. And if you took out a home equity loan and you aren't protected, you need to get help now. Let me repeat, the banks aren't going to protect you and our government isn't doing a thing for you. So you need to get to a housing counselor. Get to one of those nonprofit groups that provide you a review of your mortgage, a review of your home equity loan, and see if you can get refinanced. Because the problem is, if you're underwater, who's going to refinance you? You're going to have difficulty, and you're going to be stuck with that $500, $600 bill a month that you can't afford. So before the crisis hits you, take action. Protect yourself. Get out there. Sit down with a housing counselor, and most importantly, look at your bill. Look at the terms of that loan from 2004. Find out if you've got a reset. Find out if it was interest only. And if it was interest only, the reset is coming next year. And the reset is going to hit you, and the banks are not going to show any mercy. They're not going to let you forget it. They're going to hit you with delinquency, and they're going to hit you with foreclosure. So the next big housing crisis bubble is here. It's now. You've got to be prepared. I'm John Mattis for Investigative Guy. If you've been hit by a scam, a schemer, let me know. Thank you.
Speaking in Julian Monday night, Bill of Rights Defense Committee attorney Matthew Pellegrew revealed that his organization on Thursday will be unveiling a new campaign called Unplug the NSA, aimed at stopping the domestic spying on Americans.
I want to tell you about something that we're going to actually unveil on Thursday, so hey, sneak peek. But this relates to NSA data collection, which also, like in the way that everything relates to everything, relates to drones and could provide a useful toolkit. So the NSA is doing its thing, and we kind of know about that now. You know what I mean? There are multiple ways to go about dealing with it. The most commonly tried, there's two bills up right now, the USA Freedom Act, which is going to amend the Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which would put oversight onto the FISA court, which would roll back NSA spying. It's kind of a long domino chain. The second is the FISA Improvement Act. They're both, that's put up by Feinstein. That is going to codify NSA spying and make it, you know, describe it as it currently exists as a legal form, which right now is constitutionally in question. Those are two different ways to attack the NSA's ability to do data collection that both involve constitutional curtailments, which is a lot about what we talk about when we talk about drones. Making it constitutional, making it conform to at least the Fourth Amendment, if not the Fifth and Fourteenth, and that's the Equal Protection Clause and the right not to give testimony against yourself, the Fifth Amendment. So there's many different constitutional avenues. They all have exceptions to them. What we're doing with the NSA is we're dealing the NSA. Brief backstory. In 2007, maxed out the Baltimore, Maryland power grid and had to move out of Baltimore. They couldn't get enough power from the generators there in order to move. So they opened up 9 other data collection centers across the country since then. One of them is in California. There's another one in Washington State. There's one in Utah. The one in Utah takes 1.7 million gallons of water a day to keep its servers cool because the data collection engines that they're running are so massive that that's kind of what it takes. They're massive energy consumers. Where does all that water and power come from? The state. There isn't an independent service provider that's capable of giving the resources to the NSA, so it all comes from state contracts. Well, what can you do with a state contract is regulate the state's ability to make contracts with specific agencies through the electorate process, basically through the legislative process. And so what we're going to do in California, what we're rolling out in California on Thursday and in 9 other states across the country, is this Unplug the NSA campaign where we're going to try to pass a law that's going to prohibit the state of California's ability to contract with the NSA in programs that could be constitutionally questionable. Effectively, not dealing with the Constitution at all, shutting off the power and water.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Now it's time for the East County Magazine Trivia Quiz. Today, my guests are John and Ed. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
All right, you ready for our first question? Why do lakeside planners want to remove a bunya tree next to the library?
The bunya tree.
Mm-hmm.
Native to Australia?
No. It causes bunions in the elders going into the library.
You're kind of close. Sounds like you guys need
some. You can't make a surfboard out of that one.
No, yeah. They're not making surfboards out of it. It might be good for the economy, but no. Okay, let's give you some choices here. The roots are undermining a sidewalk. The crown is shading solar panels. The tree is in the way of a library expansion, or falling 20-pound pine cones are safety hazards.
Pine cones, big safety hazard. I've stumbled on them and a number of times.
You got it. That's right. That's right. This is a tree that dates back to prehistoric times. It has the world's largest pine cones.
Who would have figured?
Okay. Next question. Hakumba Hot Springs recently installed a 1,200-pound statue at its community center depicting something commonly seen in East County. What is it?
Nudists running around in that area.
No, they do have a clothing optional resort out there, but it is not a statue of nudists. This is a library where kids go.
I think I remember this one. Is it a rattlesnake?
You've got it. A rattlesnake. That's right.
Stumped that one.
It's a tough okay. People in this town there. Okay. Next question. Famous Western artist Olaf Wiegehorst, who used to live in El Cajon, formerly gained fame for rescuing many people as a member of New York's Mounted Police Force. How did he first learn his horseman skills that enabled him to save over 100 people on horseback in Central Park?
He was originally in the Polish cavalry in 1939 to 1941.
Well,
good guess, but as far as I know, that's not true. But it's not where he learned his horsemanship skills.
I was thinking that he probably played polo.
Nope. Okay, let's give you guys some choices. Did he first learn his horseman skills as a racehorse jockey, a cowboy, a Wild West show star, or a circus acrobat?
I guess polo wasn't on there.
No,
circus acrobat, I think, is exactly what he was.
He was a circus acrobat. He actually was all of those things except a jockey. He was a cowboy, a Wild West star. But when he was a young man, he traveled through Europe supporting his family as a circus acrobat.
And how is that different than the Polish cavalry?
I don't know. Okay, here's another one. El Cajon recently voted to get rid of something unpopular. What was it?
Besides the city council?
And besides, they're still
the
there.
Mayor.
The mayor. Well, they did get rid of the mayor, actually. He resigned, but that was besides that.
Oh, there was something about they were doing something with their liquor stores a while ago. I remember they changed their liquor laws.
El Cajon got rid of liquor?
Well,
they do have a deemed approved alcohol ordinance that restricted alcohol. So actually, we're going to give you kind of half a point. You're right. But that was not the what I had in mind. The options were jaywalking tickets, red light cameras, library fines, or parking meters.
Parking meters, hopefully?
Nope. John?
Red light cameras.
You got it.
Excellent.
Along with
good for them.
Poway, San Diego, some other cities, too, have done that. Okay. Santee's city council recently opened a session with a religious message. What was it?
It was not a Buddhist message, nor was it Muslim.
Nope, it wasn't. Okay, let me give you some choices, though. It may surprise you. Was it a Hindu mantra, a Jewish Torah reading, a Muslim prayer, or an evangelical sermon?
An evangelical sermon.
Nope. Even though this is East County, no, they actually opened it with
a mantra?
Ed got it right. A Hindu mantra. Amazing. Okay.
They did yoga for a while, too.
Om. Yeah, maybe they thought they all needed to meditate a little, mellow out there. Okay. Ratepayers in San Diego are paying the highest electric utility rates in the nation, but SDG&E's CEO has a salary of $3.9 million. How much did it increase in 10 years? What percent?
Only 10% per year.
Nope.
I would say a 40% increase.
Nope. 10 years? Nope. Let me give you some choices. Was it 50%, 100%, 200%, or 400%?
400% because he... because he did such a good job gouging rate.
Yes, you got it.
Wow.
You got it, exactly.
So it was 10 times what I had said.
Okay, and one more for you guys. Okay, you're doing pretty good here. Where in East County would you find mudbogging, monster trucks, and a demolition derby?
Where in East County? The rodeo?
Lakeside.
That was one of my guesses, but no, that was a fake-out answer. Other choices were the
Saturday night in downtown El Cajon.
Well, you might, but not that I know of. The other choices were the Hakumba Jamboree, the Laguna Mountain Rendezvous, or the El Cajon Speedway.
El Cajon Speedway.
Nope.
Wow.
Nope. You might find the monster trucks, but the mud bogging and the demolition derby and all three of those together, it's a new event, the Hakumba Jamboree.
Cool.
I'll be there.
Right.
Demolition derby and mud buggy and big
that
truck.
That's
an all-American big trucks and demolition derbies. There. You can't get that.
And that concludes this edition of the East County Magazine Trivia Quiz. And thank you for joining us.
This is Ed Barreno with the Health Alert. Sandwiches and salads sold by a California company, Glass Onion Catering, have been recalled due to possible contamination with E. coli. Some of the products were sold at Trader Joe's, Fresh Foods California, and Atherstone Fine Foods. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service has announced that more than 181,000 pounds of the ready-to-eat salads and sandwich wrap products with cooked chicken and ham were recalled. The products were sold between September 23rd and November 6th. There have been 15 cases of illness believed to be associated with the products so far. The recalled products contain the code P34221. While most cases of E. coli will resolve within a week, the bacterial infection can cause kidney failure or death, so contact your doctor if you believe you may have eaten a contaminated sandwich or salad.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. In the dimly lit confines of the fruit-packing plants that once dotted East County, men and women, but mainly women, worked as sorters and packers of lemons and oranges bound for rail shipment to points across America. Today, we bring you a little memoir of life in a fruit-packing plant during the Great Depression, written by Estelle Tooker of Tennessee. Her discussion of making ends meet with a little daughter to raise and an ailing war veteran husband to care for will resonate with many modern people. Here are her words, written in 1979 when she was 78 years old. My husband, Earl Tooker, and I, with our two-year-old daughter, Ione, arrived in San Diego by train from Sioux City, Iowa, in January 1923. We had $50 and very little else. We stayed in a hotel, eating our meals out, and it soon became obvious our $50 was not going to last. But it was our good fortune when a realtor told us we could rent a little place in Lemon Grove for $15. We had no idea where Lemon Grove was, but the important thing was that we would have a place to live and still have a few dollars left until Earl's pension check would arrive. He was a disabled World War I veteran, gassed in France by the Germans, and we had come to California because of his poor health. So there we were in our little place, located on the west side of Old Imperial Avenue, running through Lemon Grove. There was three rooms, furnished with a kerosene-burning stove for cooking, a table, a chair or two, and a bed. There were some chickens, good laying hens, and the remains of what had been a little vegetable garden. So We had plenty of eggs, and we had carrots and peas, and that was it. When the rainy season began in January, our tar paper roof developed many holes. Before the season ended, we were expert in keeping dry with every available pot and pan to catch the water. But it was so cold, we resorted to wrapping ourselves in throw rugs to keep warm. By February, our $50 was long gone, and the expected pension check from the government did not arrive. We knew no one in Lemon Grove except Tony Sonka, who ran the general store, so we took the gold wristwatch my parents had given me on my 18th birthday and gave it to Mr. Sonka as security for groceries until our money came. He was so kind and generous to us. Then we were offered a chance to move and live rent-free in another house in Lemon Grove, and in return, we took care of the house, the chickens, the garden, the berry bushes, and the nanny goats who supplied us with a lot of milk. My husband, Earl, was a telegraph operator by trade, and when his health permitted, he worked as relief man for all the different stations on the San Diego and Arizona Railway line, which ran from San Diego to Yuma, Arizona. In 1927, he got the permanent job as depot agent at the railroad depot located across the street from Sonka's store in Lemon Grove, and that's when I went to work at the packing house, packing lemons. My husband's duties at the depot consisted of receiving and delivering telegrams, sealing and routing the loaded cars of lemons being shipped out of the grove, and handling freight and supplies to the growers all over town. He worked there till 1931, when his health failed completely. My work at the packing house consisted of two departments where women did most of the work. We took turns. When the lemons were first brought in from the orchards, they were green, hard as rock. They were dumped into a huge tank, filled with some kind of solution, washed with big brushes. That was a two-man job, back and forth and back and forth. And then they came out on a conveyor belt in all sizes. Two women to a box, picked them off the belt, grading by size and quality. They were then taken to the basement and stored until time to pack for shipping. And that season began in May. A lemon packer was paid higher than a washer, but it was piecework. You had to pack 10,000 lemons a day in order to earn $3. On a good day, we would earn $4 or $5. Minimum wage was 33 and a third cents an hour. That was the Great Depression. But still, it was fascinating to watch those women work, all standing beside the moving belt, lemons tumbling along so fast, all arms reaching out to pick a lemon, and as if with one movement, a methodical swish, a simple twist of the hand into a square piece of labeled sun-kissed paper and into the box. Then with lightning speed, a packer would swing the box around, fill the other half, place a card on top, swing it to another belt going in the opposite direction, and start another box. The packed one was then lidded in an operation performed by the pressman. We never knew when one of our boxes would be inspected. If it passed inspection, we got paid for an extra box. We had to repack the entire box if it did not pass inspection. The lemon sizes were based on the number of lemons it took to fill a packed box. Some of those sizes were 300, 360, 520, and so on. As many as 200 freight cars of lemons a season were shipped from Lemon Grove. The season was May through September, but washing those lemons was more or less all year round. I'll always remember our close friends and neighbors from that time. We made a little bit of money, and they all came by to see our very first washing machine. Y'all might know that Big Lemon. My husband was part of building it in 1928. We never dreamed it would become a permanent historical landmark, but it's still there. In 1934, my husband was sent up to the Veterans Hospital in San Fernando, and for a year we tried to keep him alive and keep him in a good climate, but he finally died. He passed away on October 25, 1937. My daughter and I returned to our old house, the one we very first moved into in Lemon Grove, and my daughter graduated from Grossmont High School in 1938, and at that time, we left Lemon Grove forever, but I will never forget it, because that little town kept us alive all through the Depression. And there you have it, dear listeners, for The Sound of History. I'm Helen Ofield.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Arielle Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. As we approach the holidays this year, we'll be bringing you holiday events in our preview section at the end of Destination East County, starting today. But right now, we want to announce a little-known secret in East County. Each holiday season and winter, skaters and non-skaters can enjoy the outdoor ice skating rink at Viejas Outlet Centers in Alpine. Larger than the famed Rockefeller Center rink in New York and reminiscent of it, the Viejas Outlet Center's rink is also the largest in Southern California. Guests can enjoy shopping, holiday decor and entertainment, and then skate, sip hot cocoa or order off a rinkside menu. The rink is now open throughout the holiday season. If skaters bring a new unwrapped toy worth $5 or more by December 4th for the East County Toy Drive, they can get a discount on skating prices. Favorite Disney characters will appear at Young Actors Theater on Campo Road in Spring Valley this weekend, where Aladdin Jr., a stage adaptation of the Disney hit film, is being performed. The production is filled with magic, mayhem, and flying carpet rides, along with the Academy Award-winning score, which includes the songs A Whole New World and Friend Like Me. The Olaf Wieghorst Museum in downtown El Cajon will be presenting a guest lecturer on Thursday, November 14th at 6:30 p.m. Mark Fellman will speak on Capturing San Diego's Nature, 100 Years of Landscape Painting. Currently, the California Art Club and Olaf Wieghorst Museum are hosting a juried art show that began in October and continues through January 11th at the museum. Enjoy a harvest moon dance in Dulzura on Saturday, November 16th from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Everyone is invited to dance by the light of the moon at Camps Grove in Dulzura. The Dulzura Community Development Committee and Dulzura Barrett Fire Department are hosting this dance and barbecue benefit event, which is for adults 21 and older. Barbecue dinners, including barbecue meat sandwiches, coleslaw, and chips may be purchased. Camps Grove is located on Highway 94 in Dulzura. There are autumn adventures in the Enza Borrego Desert. Autumn nights are ideal for several special upcoming experiences, ranging from a classical guitar concert by moonlight in the Red Rock Canyon area to two overnight campouts for stargazers, including a chance to view an upcoming meteor shower and the spectacular comet Ison. Hosted by California Overland Desert Excursions, the first event happens this weekend, and then we will have a preview of their upcoming events throughout November and December. Classical Guitar Under the Moon is an evening with musician Michael McCormick on Friday, November 15th. This memorable music, enhanced by the natural acoustics, a beautiful Hawk Canyon, and a chuck wagon dinner. Camp Beneath the Stars. Astronomer Scott Baker will host this event on Saturday, November 23rd. Fall camping is idyllic in the Enza Borrego Desert, especially when you're in the company of an astronomer and his telescope. Chuck wagon dinner will also be provided. And you can enjoy the upcoming meteor shower overnight and maybe spy the comet on Friday, December 13th. Viewing the starry skies with professional astronomer and famed night sky photographer Dennis Mamana. The annual Geminids meteor shower should be better than average this year. Back in town, and some would say back to reality, the Lamplighters Community Theater presents a staged reading of Hot Flashes, the comedy. Curtain times are 7:30 p.m., Friday, November 22nd, and Saturday, November 23rd, with a matinee at 2 p.m. on Sunday, November 24th. If you are looking for a place to do some early holiday shopping, Descanso is hosting an arts and crafts fair next Saturday on November 23rd from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's at the Descanso Town Hall in Descanso, California, where shoppers can enjoy free refreshments, listen to some wonderful live music, and purchase handcrafted items, all while taking in the fresh mountain air along with a little backcountry hospitality. Fusion Glass Gallery and Studio is hosting its annual holiday show and 10th anniversary party on Saturday, November 30th at 7 p.m. on La Mesa Boulevard in La Mesa. Guests can enjoy a bounty of beautiful artworks by a bevy of talented local artists while feasting on appetizers, sipping wines and beers, and savoring a champagne toast. The jazz style of local musician Bo Downey will be performed, and there will be a photo booth just for fun. The dress theme for the evening is sparkles. The Mother Goose Parade will be held for the 67th time on Sunday, November 24th in downtown El Cajon. The parade begins at 10 a.m. at the corner of East Main Street and Magnolia Avenue, continuing eastbound on East Main Street all the way to 2nd Street. Enjoy marching bands, local dignitaries, and parade floats. After the parade, spectators can stop by the Mother Goose Village at the Prescott Promenade for more fun activities. Waddle and Trot 5K is a new East County Thanksgiving tradition. On Thursday, November 28th at 8 a.m., Pathways Community Church will be hosting the second annual Waddle and Trot 5K and Fun Run. This fun family event is intended for runners and walkers of every fitness level, and all proceeds will go to Santee Santas and the Santee Food Bank. Race participants will begin in the Pathways Center at the corner of Mast and Carlton Hills. The course is described as flat and fast. A post-race celebration includes refreshments and vendor booths, as well as prizes for the fastest runners. A fun run is planned for kids age 10 and under and kicks off at 9 a.m. within the Pathways parking lot. That's all for this week. All of these events and more can be found on our calendar and in our festivals and events section at www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County!
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.